from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Tuesday was a busy day for the Kiev government with a number of significant developments, some hopeful, some troubling, and some seemingly headed for trouble at a later date. In a single session of the Ukrainian parliament, amnesty and autonomy were offered to the people in eastern Ukraine, along with elections scheduled for early December. However, the elections would take place without the participation of the main political party of the East, the Party of Regions, which was banned by a new law that would also mandate that all government officials connected to the party be removed from any government post and barred from ever returning to office. And whatever new government takes form out of the new laws passed at Tuesday's session will take office subject to a new association agreement binding Ukraine to the European Union, which was also approved Tuesday. First, RT's Roman Kosarov reports from Donetsk about the autonomy, amnesty, and elections bills, and the prospects for at least a short-term peace in the east.
The special status was awarded to the Donetsk and Luhansk regions here in the east of Ukraine by the Ukrainian parliament. This was offered by President Petro Poroshenko a little earlier. However, this self-administration will last for 3 years. Still unclear what will happen after that. Now, along with this bill, an amnesty law was also implemented for all the people that participated in the crisis here in the east of Ukraine. And also, according to the documents, early elections will be held here in the east of Ukraine on the 7th of December, local elections right here. Now, leaders of the more radical pro-Western parties have already expressed their outrage at this bill and said that they did not vote for it at all. Now, the special status and along with the ceasefire were talked about, were implemented in the Minsk protocol by the parties more than a week ago. Now, the truce here is being largely observed. It's been holding for about 11 days or so, even though it's sometimes marred by sporadic fighting, and we still hear about civilians dying as a result of shelling. But largely, the fact what took place today in Kiev, perhaps it would lead to an end to violence here in the east of Ukraine. And we already see something like that in refugees returning back home from Russia.
Political analyst Alexander Pavich took a closer look at the new agreements and the context in which they were reached. He spoke with RT's Kevin Owen from Belgrade, Serbia.
This is a good first step, but we must remember some things. This is the same parliament that earlier in the year practically banned the Russian language from being an official language in Ukraine. This is the same parliament who is now reinstating it. So what happened in the meantime? In the meantime, they tried to suppress it by force. And when they couldn't get it done, when they couldn't suppress the Russian-speaking population, drive it out of Ukraine if possible, now they're ready for compromise. But okay, still, it's good that a step has been taken in that direction.
But however, as you say, I'm sorry to jump in here, Alexander, but you mentioned the word compromise here. Ukraine's president has said there'll be no federalization and Donetsk and Luhansk regions will remain part of Ukraine. So how can you actually read into the special status then? It seems that we're getting conflicting statements out of Kiev.
Well, this is the thing. This is a step. You're absolutely right. It's a step in that direction. It's a compromise compared to what this same parliament did in February and March. And it's a direct result of the resistance that was formed, organized in reaction to what they were doing, what Kiev was doing earlier in the year. The Minsk agreement, we must remember, the representatives of Donbas, Lugansk, and Donetsk are now a party to the conflict. They were signatories to this agreement. So we need to hear what they have to say about this. And it's not just on Kiev anymore. And I think official Russia said the other day, this is something that has to be worked out between Kiev and Donbas. So we need to hear from the other side. Also, you're absolutely right. There are conflicting signals coming from Kiev. Mr. Poroshenko said the other day, well, special status is something that will last for only 3 years. Now, that's a mixed signal, to say the least. It's also a bit disingenuous. I think if anyone in Donetsk and Lugansk hears this is something for only 3 years, I don't think, you know, I think they'll say, well, this is not a serious offer. So it may be that this is only an offer for the public in Ukraine, which is unhappy with the war, for the Western public, to give Kiev some sort of a connotation of being peacemakers. But we'll see what their deeds are. So far, it's not very encouraging, even though the ceasefire, as I say, is holding. But I think it's only because Kiev hasn't recovered from the vast military losses that they've suffered in the last month.
Yeah, that's what many people have been saying, a lot of analysts saying that Kiev only moved towards the truce in eastern Ukraine because it was losing very, very badly. Parliament members have ruled out any possible alliance or association with self-proclaimed eastern leaders. Do you think that means the regions could remain ostracized despite any official special status?
Well, absolutely. How can you not talk to the people who now clearly represent the population of Donbas, of both Donetsk and Lugansk? If you do that, then in advance, you're practically eliminating any chance for real peace and real talks. So once again, when you look at this a little bit more closely, it looks more like posturing by Kiev than anything else. However, diplomacy, public diplomacy is also a game. This is part of the game. So we have to see, and we have to wait and see what the official response from Donbas, from the legitimate representatives of Donbas, will be. We haven't heard it yet, I don't think.
But while peace was being proclaimed from Kiev, the attacks by the Ukrainian military upon the east produced more casualties on Tuesday. We have this report from Press TV.
Donetsk City Council says the Monday shelling was the worst reported violence since the ceasefire between Russian-backed militia and Ukrainian troops took effect on September the 5th. Fighting around the eastern city's government-held airport left surrounding areas in the crossfire. Two northern neighborhoods were shelled heavily on Sunday, leading to casualties and damaging homes and offices. The UN says over 3,000 people, including civilians and Ukrainian troops, have lost their lives since the conflict erupted in mid-April.
As Washington begins to focus military assets back onto Iraq and officially for the first time on Syria, the chaos continues in another country still suffering from the aftermath of a U.S.-backed regime change. RT's Gayan Chichikayan reports.
With the Islamic State group rampant in Iraq and Syria, Libya seems to be off the media radar. But the country is becoming a new hub for terrorists. Europe, being just a boat ride away from Libya, is raising the alarm.
The south is a sort of hub for terrorist groups, where they come to resupply, including with weapons. In the north, the political and economic centers of the country are now at risk from falling under jihadist control.
Jihadists have already seized control of its capital, Tripoli, forcing the Libyan government to relocate to the country's east. In the growing state of anarchy, and with fears that Libya is turning into the next Iraq, many look back at when the chaos began.
The United States led the effort to pass a historic resolution at the Security Council authorizing all necessary measures to protect the Libyan people.
3 years after NATO helped take out Colonel Gaddafi, the Libyans are as unprotected as ever, with rival militias struggling to take control of the country. Europe, too, is becoming increasingly vulnerable to the forces the chaos has unleashed.
Europe is certainly easily victimized by any terrorism that might come from North Africa. Not only are there large expatriate and immigrant populations in a variety of countries in Europe that come from that region, but also there's just the obvious proximity between Libya, North Africa, and Southern Europe, which, of course, would be a highway to the rest of Europe. And that spillover will happen in Europe, not the United States.
The U.S. is now gearing up for action in Syria.
I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq.
The Obama administration plans to ramp up the arming and training of Syrian rebels, which they will use to fight not only jihadists of the Islamic State group, but also the Assad government. And many ask whether Assad's fall could benefit extremists the way chaos in Libya did.
The U.S. has shown itself to be very eager to remove leaders in Iraq, in Libya, and now in Syria. But wouldn't there be a better chance for peace if Washington chose to deal with governments already in place instead of undermining them and then facing the so-called unintended consequences in the form of rampant terror?
U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon put out a general call Monday for all nations to stop funding terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Daniel Dickinson reports from the UN.
Governments around the world have been urged to cooperate in stopping financing for foreign fighters who join Islamist militants in Iraq and Syria. The appeal has come from the UN Secretary General as a major conference on peace and security in Iraq was being held in Paris on Monday. Fighters from different countries, including Western nations, are reported to have joined the militant Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, known as ISIS. UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric says the Secretary General's Special Representative for Iraq, Nikolai Umladinov, attended the Paris conference.
In his remarks delivered on behalf of the Secretary General, Mr. Mladenov called upon member states to cooperate in enforcing the sanctions adopted by the UN Security Council Resolution 2107, calling on those states to act to suppress the flow of foreign fighters, financing, and other support to Islamic extremist groups in Iraq and in Syria. Mr. Mladenov further underlined that growing international consensus to fight Islamic extremist groups must also be governed by international law and standards that uphold the protection of civilians.
A humanitarian crisis has unfolded following attacks by ISIS militants, which have forced thousands of civilians to flee their homes in Iraq. The head of the UN humanitarian agency, OCHA, Valerie Amos, concluded a three-day visit to the country over the weekend. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
The so-called Islamic State may have used chemical weapons in an attack on Iraqi forces in the town of Dhuluya, about 43 miles north of Baghdad, this according to a tweet from a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, taking note of the fact that, because he was not in Dhuluya, he could not verify the information. Reporter Matt Bradley posted to his Twitter page about, quote, reports that Islamic State used chlorine gas in an assault on Iraq security forces this afternoon in Dhuluya. There are now 12 people afflicted with chlorine gas poisoning in Dhuluya, Iraq, following Islamic State attack on Iraqi security forces, closed quote. There were also reports Tuesday that the Syrian army killed 37 Islamic State fighters in the northeastern province Deir al-Zor during an offensive launched by Syrian government forces in the region in the eastern frontier near Iraq. After several days of continuous fighting and the liberation by Syrian troops of the city of al-Bukamal, most Islamic State field commanders reportedly retreated to the Syria-Iraq border. The group has been trying to seize a Syrian airbase in Deir al-Zor since early September. However, the position of government forces improved after the Syrian army destroyed a strategically important bridge Monday. The so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIL and ISIS, has been fighting the Syrian government since 2012 and began launching attacks against northern and western Iraq this past June. The group has seized sizable areas in both countries and has proclaimed an Islamic caliphate in all of the lands under its control. Also Tuesday, General Martin Dempsey, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. He made it clear that the current U.S. military activity will be extended into Syria and that the fight can be expected to last a long time.
As long as ISIL enjoys a safe haven in Syria, it will remain a formidable force and a threat. So, while this work in Iraq is taking place, we will simultaneously pressure ISIL in Syria. With coalition partners and contributions, we will begin building a force of vetted, trained, moderate Syrians to take on ISIL in Syria. We will work to ensure that they have a Syrian chain of command and report to a moderate political authority. This force will work initially at the local and community level and help pull together Syrians who have most felt the harsh hand of ISIL. In conjunction with that long-term effort, we will be prepared to strike ISIL targets in Syria that degrade ISIL's capabilities. This won't look like a shock and awe campaign because that's simply not how ISIL is organized, but it will be a persistent and sustainable campaign. Given a coalition of capable, willing regional and international partners, I believe we can destroy ISIL in Iraq, restore the Iraq-Syria border, and disrupt ISIL in Syria. ISIL will ultimately be defeated when their cloak of religious legitimacy is stripped away and the population on which they have imposed themselves reject them. Our actions are intended to move in that direction. This will require a sustained effort over an extended period of time. It's a generational problem. But I am growing increasingly uncomfortable that the will to provide means does not match the will to pursue ends. The Secretary and I are doing what we can inside the department to bridge that gap, but we'll need your help. If we do not depart from our present path over time, I will have fewer military options to offer to the Secretary and to the President. And that's not a position in which I want to find myself.
When pressed on that last point, the general appeared to put the option of U.S. ground troops squarely on the table.
In terms of utilizing the on the ground, the forces that are Syrian and Iraqi rather than Western forces, is that part of the thinking at this time as well, to avoid a Western ground force in a Arab or Muslim country for the same reason that you just gave?
Well, I do think that the approach to build a coalition and enable it leads me to leverage our unique capabilities, which tend to be, as I mentioned, the ability to train and plan and provide intelligence and provide air power. As I said in my statement, however, my view at this point is that this coalition is the appropriate way forward. I believe that will prove true. But if it fails to be true, and if there are threats to the United States, then I, of course, would go back to the President and make a recommendation that may include the use of U.S. military ground forces.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, Dr. Bashar Ja'afari, held a press conference Tuesday to discuss the situation after a session of the UN Security Council.
As you know, Jabhat al-Nusra fighters, terrorist fighters, which is, as you know, according to the Security Council resolutions, an offshoot of the Al-Qaeda, affiliated to Al-Qaeda. These terrorist fighters of al-Nusra Front have succeeded with the help of the Israeli side and the Qatari intervention and assistance and involvement, succeeded in occupying almost all the Syrian side of the line of demarcation, meaning that the terrorists have replaced so far the UNDOF forces deployed on the Syrian side of the line of demarcation. Almost all of the UNDOF forces deployed on the Syrian side have moved now to the Israeli side and reduced their mandate given to them by the Security Council Disengagement Forces Agreement of 1974 to only observing these alarming developments on the Syrian side, meaning that they withdrew to the Israeli side and accepted to play the role of only watching what's going on the other side, which is supposedly the headquarters of UNDOF on the Syrian side and the UNDOF's locations and positions along this line of demarcation. Unfortunately, the UNDOF forces, as I said, evacuated suddenly its positions on the Syrian side of the line of demarcation in a violation of the mandate and without prior consultations with the Syrian government. This act gave the opportunity to the terrorists to take over the UNDOF forces, positions, materials, equipment, and created by doing so a kind of safe zone for the terrorists to operate against the Syrian army, departing from the UNDOF positions that they occupied, as I have explained. Every time the Syrian army used to intervene to chase these terrorists out of the line of demarcation, we were called by the DPKO to hear that we are violating the disengagement forces agreement. But now, as these terrorists have occupied the whole line of demarcation, the DPKO did not call on the Israeli side, did not call on the Qatari side, did not call on the Jordanian side to ask them to stop intervening in letting these terrorists infiltrating the area. And these terrorists, as you know, as I said at the beginning, are all of them belonging to Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a terrorist entity, forgotten by those who are claiming, holding international conferences in Paris and elsewhere and Jeddah to combat only ISIS. They forgot that the resolution 2170 spoke about ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, not only about ISIS. So this is a kind of hypocrite behavior, unacceptable, very dangerous for the safety and security of the Syrian territory and the Syrian population and the Syrian army also. So I would like to draw your kind of attention to all these very alarming points. I will share these concerns with some of the members of the Security Council as well as with the Secretary General. I forwarded on behalf of my government yesterday two identical letters to the Secretary General himself as well as to the President of the Security Council, the U.S. Ambassador, asking both of them to circulate this letter as an official document of the United Nations. The point, the ultimate point that I would like to draw your kind attention to it is that such an occupation by Jabhat al-Nusra terrorist fighters would lead with the help and assistance, direct help and assistance by the Israelis and the Qataris intelligence, as I said. This will lead automatically to create a kind of safe zone in the Golan, similar to that one which was established by the Israelis in South Lebanon after the invasion of 1987. So the Israelis are playing with the fire. They are escalating the situation. There is a total unacceptable inaction by the DPKO. The Secretary General is absent. The Security Council is not reacting in spite of the kidnapping by the terrorist groups of the Fijian soldiers and the threatening of the lives of the Filipinos operating within UNDOF forces in the Syrian occupied, in the occupied Syrian Golan. It is not anymore about double standards policies. It's even worse than that. It's a total inaction, absence of action, total inaction by all those who are responsible for the lives of UNDOF forces, soldiers, as well as for fulfilling the mandate of UNDOF in accordance with the Disengagement Forces Agreement of 1974. Why I am focusing on this issue, it's because once these terrorists have succeeded in establishing this safe zone in the Golan, replacing the positions taken off by previously by UNDOF, this a new fact, fait accompli, will give the Israelis the opportunity to infiltrate further into the Syrian territory, to help further the terrorist groups in order to create a new situation prevailing on the Syrian side and starting a war of attrition against the Syrian army without the presence of any international eyewitnesses, because UNDOF will not be there anymore. So there will be nobody to, even theoretically speaking, brief the Security Council and the DPKO about what's going on in the Golan. This is a very big plot involving the Israelis, involving the Qataris, involving the Jordanians, and all these governments should be held responsible by the Security Council, so that we prevent what would be worse.
If you can say more, what kind of equipment and material did the UNDOF leave behind for al-Nusra to use? And also, what was the Syrian government's position on the order to surrender? The Filipinos have said that they were ordered by the force commander to surrender to Jabhat al-Nusra, and they refused and got away. It seems like the Fijians did. What's behind DPKO ordering the surrender and leaving this equipment behind?
That was a great confusion among the UNDOF forces, soldiers themselves. Indeed, as you said, as far as we know, the chief commander of UNDOF ordered the Filipinos to surrender and to give up their weapons to the terrorist groups. The Filipinos called their headquarters in Manila. The chief of the Filipinos army ordered them differently, asking them not to surrender and not to give up their weapons. We were asked by both the Filipino contingent in the Golan and the Filipino government to cover the Filipinos' soldiers in the Golan surrounded by the terrorists, militarily speaking, something that we did. So we covered the Filipinos' soldiers many times upon their own request, so that they succeeded leaving their position and going to another position which is safer. So indeed, the Fijians did not do that. The Fijians listened to the orders and instructions from the chief commander and gave up their instructions. We don't know whether the chief commander of UNDOF gave these instructions on his own or after consultation with Mr. Latsous in New York. This is something that needs to be clarified later on. As with regard the equipments and the materials, as you know, the Fijians surrendered not only their equipments and weapons, but they also surrendered their uniforms and cars. So the terrorists are using now United Nations cars, which hold the emblem of the United Nations forces in the Golan. They are using the uniform of the UNDOF, the weapons of UNDOF, the positions of UNDOF to shell and on the Syrian army as well as on the civilian Syrian villages populations. It's very, very alarming development, where everybody should be held accountable. If there is something called Security Council responsible for maintaining peace and security. Yes.
Today in Geneva, the UN Commission investigating war crimes in Syria blamed President Bashar al-Assad's government for committing the bulk of the killing. What's your response to what they are saying right now in Geneva?
Our ambassador in Geneva responded immediately to this statement. But just to make a long story short, this commission did not cooperate with the Syrian government at all while investigating these facts. This commission did not go to Syria. This commission's members did not interview any Syrian inside Syria. This commission has been biased from the beginning because the High Commissioner, the previous one, was not genuine in its approach towards the Syrian crisis. Then now, you know, what used to be called the friends of the Syrian people, numbered by 137, now they are only 11, because all Everybody have opened their eyes, and they know now what's going on in Syria.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.